From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakraborty, and this is On Point. My first dorm room freshman year in college was your basic concrete block with a couple of desks and bunk beds and a super flattering overhead fluorescent light. Not that I'm really pining for the good old days, but there was something about the idea that a whole bunch of people in my hall from different places, different backgrounds, different experiences were all thrown together to learn from and live with each other. Well, now things are, of course, different on many American campuses. Luxury living is in. In fact, private developers are partnering with some colleges to build super luxe apartment-style dorms for students who can afford it. Colleges say it saves them money, which can then be spent on actual education, but critics say it's driving inequality on campus. So this hour on Point, American colleges, private developers, and luxury student housing. And you can join us. What are your thoughts about the impact, of potential impact of private development on college campuses? Do you buy the idea that it frees up potentially hundreds of millions of dollars for some universities to funnel back into education if they don't have to build new dorms? Or do you fear it's really undermining this idea that college is a place where we all get to rub shoulders with one another? Rub elbows, rub shoulders. I'm mixing my metaphors today. Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Well, joining me in the studio is Deirdre Fernandez. She's a reporter for the Boston Globe covering New England's education economy. She wrote an article this year headlined "Pricey Campus Housing Triggers a Debate in Boston," and we've got a link to that at onpointradio.org. Deirdre, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me here.
Okay, so first of all, you begin your story with a development at Northeastern University. Take us inside this super luxe accommodation. What's it like?
So basically, this is Lightview Apartments that's across the street from Northeastern's campus, and they have floor-to-ceiling windows, lots of light coming in, stainless steel appliances.
Granite countertops.
Granite countertops, yes. It's like nothing that you and I were used to. No cinder blocks, nothing like that, and just it's just a different style of living, and there are a lot of these apartment buildings showing up across the country in different college campuses. You know, they have stacked washer and dryers at some of these places, where I can't remember having a stacked washer and dryer until I was several years out of college in my living.
I couldn't even find the laundromat my first year in college for most of it. But so how much does it cost then to live there?
So the one in Northeastern is a year-round lease. So basically, unlike the dorm rooms, they're 8 months for when the students are on campus. These are one-year leases, and they're about $16,000, $17,000 a year. So basically, they were a couple of $1,000s more when it's a year-round situation than what it costs to live on campus.
Right. I'm seeing $16,000 a year for a shared room.
Yeah.
$19,000 for a single. And then, as you report, you compare that to $12,000 on Northeastern's campus for the most expensive on-campus shared dorm.
Yeah. So there is a price, and it's actually what the financial aid is at Northeastern. The average financial aid for room and board is about, I think, $15,000 or so. So you can see there's a gap for students who are looking at these Lightview apartments.
Right.
If you're on financial aid, you're going to have to find a way to cover that cost.
So, but they're popular, though. I mean, is it full?
Yeah. At least when I was reporting the story, it was close to full. So, and they're supposed to open this fall.
Okay. So this is really interesting because how did Northeastern, and again, it's obviously Northeastern is not the only place this is happening. It's happening on college campuses in many parts of the country. But how did Northeastern come by the idea of partnering with a private developer to create student housing?
Well, Northeastern is in the city. So one of the things that's happening here in Boston is that there are a lot of college students coming in, and it's pushed creating a housing crisis of sorts for people who actually live here and work here. So one of the things that Northeastern says that it's been trying to do is get more students to live on university-type housing instead of in the rental spaces and rent homes in the Boston area, so the workers can actually rent the spaces. But the other part for Northeastern is that it saves the college money. You know, they don't have to build. They lease the land, and they don't have to put the upfront costs of constructing hundreds of millions of dollars to construct a new dorm.
No, I mean, Northeastern told you it saved them at least $100 million.
Yeah, yeah. So Oh, $100 million. I'm sorry. Yeah. Yeah, millions of dollars, because it does cost them a lot of money. And a lot of these schools are really cautious about putting additional debt on their books. And they can save, at least in Northeastern's case, put that money towards research, towards more financial aid for students, towards other things that a college has to pay for.
Okay. So just to be clear, Northeastern owns the land that this particular dorm is on.
Yes.
But this private developer owns the building?
Yeah. So that's kind of the situation.
So the students are paying rent to this private developer.
Yeah.
Okay. And so, I mean, do you buy that in the course of your reporting that, like, this was actually a boon for arguably, Northeastern is saying it's a boon for all students if they're able to save the money and put it back into, you know, the core function of the university.
Yeah. You know, it's a good argument to be making. I mean, it's a housing building, new buildings, it's expensive. And a lot of these colleges no longer want them on their books, basically, and don't want to be carrying that debt for a long time. And in Boston, their real estate is one of their biggest assets at this point. And this is a way that they feel like they can save money, put the money back, but also outsource, basically, this very central function.
Mm, mm-hmm. Well, but essentially what they're outsourcing, or the manner that they're outsourcing, is very analogous to the housing issues that lots of cities have across the country anyway. That what's being built is for the students who can most afford it, and not the students, as you were saying, who are on significant amounts of financial aid.
Yeah. Exactly. I mean, it is. I mean, I think a lot of these universities, like Tufts, for example, they're very cognizant about what they're creating and whether the culture they're creating is not analogous to what they're supposed to be doing and what their aspirations are for universities, right? That you're basically creating this environment where people come in from all over the country, from lots of different income levels, to kind of gather together, learn from each other, and whether you're creating a place where, you know, only the richest students are rubbing shoulders with each other at one place and learning from each other. And what do you take to the outside afterwards?
Okay, so Deirdre, stand by here for just a second, because I want to bring into the conversation Jeff Jones. He's joining us from Blue Mountain Beach, Florida. He's principal at Capstone Development Partners, a student housing development company that's focused on working with colleges and universities in public-private partnerships. I guess some of them are private colleges, but partnerships. And they recently completed a new residence and dining hall at the University of Massachusetts Boston. That building accommodates more than 1,000 first-year and transfer students. So, Jeff Jones, welcome to you.
Thank you so much. Appreciate you having me.
It's great to have you. So tell us more about why Capstone Development is in this business.
We are in the business to assist universities and colleges in fulfilling their mission to house and educate their students. And we have developed over the last 20 to 30 years a good deal of expertise, experience, lessons learned that we can bring to universities to help them in the design, construction, financing, and operation of quality housing at the most affordable rental rates possible. I think it's really important not to overgeneralize about what is being done through these university developer or public-private partnerships, because all of these developments, all of these new communities that are being built are not alike. Mm-hmm. And I'd like to just draw some distinctions to some of the work that we've been doing compared to the community at Northeastern that you've been speaking of.
Yeah, sure. Go ahead. Would love to hear that.
Sure. Well, I would say to you that our company's commitment and the commitment of most of the 70 universities and colleges with which we have partnered over the past 20 years are, in fact, committed to the most affordable housing possible, but yet there are competing goals for this housing. Universities want quality-built facilities. We all want that. Well-designed, thoughtfully designed facilities that offer programs and academic support facilities and amenities. They want sustainability and energy efficiency. All of those goals require the expenditure of funds And in today's construction market, it's getting more and more expensive to build that kind of facility. And yet we're striving constantly to maintain affordable room and rental rates. And I think some projects and some universities and some developers do that better than others. And that's why I think it's important not to overgeneralize about what's being delivered through these partnerships.
Yeah, I hear you. So Jeff Jones, though, let me ask you, when you say affordable, I mean, there's a lot of contention over what that means just in the regular housing market. So what does affordable mean here in student housing that you're working on? For example, the one that you just completed at the University of Massachusetts Boston. What does affordable mean there?
Well, I think you're right. Affordable is in the eye of the beholder, and it's a tricky term to define. We like to use as affordable or the most affordable rates possible given all of the market conditions and the community features and elements combined. But at UMass Boston, where the demographic factors are such that affordability is critical, we specifically designed the community for efficiency. We built at a cost-competitive rate, and we programmed the facility so that we could achieve the lowest possible rates. And our rates there range from the low $4,000 per semester per person for shared rooms up to roughly $6,000 for private single occupancy rooms with a private bathroom. So we have a range of unit types that meet various price points, with a good number of those price points on the lowest end of that spectrum.
Interesting. So Jeff Jones, stand by for just a second, and Deirdre Fernandez, hang on here for a moment as well. We got to take a quick break. We are talking about private developers working with colleges and universities, some of them public colleges and universities, as you just heard, others private, on creating student housing, but whether or not a lot of that is luxury housing, this is On Point. We'll be right back.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking about colleges and universities, many across the nation, who have moved to partnering with private development companies to create new student housing. And sounds like a great idea, but on certain campuses, that housing tends to be on the luxury end of things that's not affordable for all students. So is that a problem? And I'm joined today by Deirdre Fernandez. She's a correspondent for the Boston Globe, and it's her story that was headlined, "Pricey Campus Housing Triggers a Debate in Boston," that inspired this hour. We have a link to that at onpointradio.org. Jeff Jones also joins us. He's principal at Capstone Development Partners. It's a student housing development company that's focused on working with colleges and universities to create new student housing. And Deirdre Fernandez, let me just turn to you briefly, because you heard Jeff Jones before the break there talking about, you know, one of their projects was working with UMass Boston, a public university, and that there they tried really hard to build this new housing that achieved all the goals of the university, but also keeping it affordable. It sounds great. I mean, like the prices that Jeff was giving us do seem relatively affordable in the greater Boston area. But why isn't that possible with other universities? Because we were talking about housing at Northeastern that costs like three times as much, four times as much.
Yeah. And I think part of it is a lot of these companies are looking at the market, right? I mean, that's what they're gauging their prices against, and whether or not kids are willing to spend that much money, what they would be willing to spend off campus for housing. And so if students in the Northeastern area are willing to spend that much, or the rental units are around that much, then they're going to price them at that point. I mean, they don't want to drive away students, but they also want to make some money. I mean, they put a lot of money into these buildings.
Yeah. Okay, so Jeff Jones, I'm still quite taken by your UMass Boston example. But let me ask you, I presume that Capstone Development wants to make a profit. It wants to be a profitable company here. So how much are you tied into pricing these student developments at market rates in the community?
Well, it's a very good question, and the answer is full of nuances because not all of these communities developed through public-private partnerships are financed or structured in the same way.
Uh-huh.
Some, like the project at Northeastern, are structured with private ownership of the housing improvements, private financing, mostly equity-based capital financing by the developer. But there are other ways that these projects are delivered. And in the case of the UMass Boston community, there was an intentional decision made that the ownership of the improvements on the ground leased from the university would be through a 501c3 not-for-profit organization, independently chartered and by the IRS to own and operate housing for the benefit of universities. So Capstone is not an owner or profit-motivated participant in that particular community. That is a not-for-profit-owned facility in which the net operating proceeds of the community flow back through the not-for-profit owner and ultimately are used to benefit the institution.
I got
Capstone
you.
Is paid a fee. We are paid a fee, a market competitive development fee, for taking the risk and responsibility for delivering on time and within budget. And then a sister company of ours manages the facility for a market competitive fee, but there is no private ownership or private profit motivation in that particular structure.
I got you.
And that does help. That does help on the affordability end of the spectrum and on the benefits of operation flowing back to the institution.
Well, Jeff Jones, principal at Capstone Development Partners, joining us today from Blue Mountain Beach, Florida. Thank you so much for being with us.
You're welcome.
Okay, so Deirdre, I'm going to go to callers here in just a second, but intriguing, not-for-profit ownership model in some of these newly developed student housing or in the new student housing. Have you seen that in other places?
I haven't seen that locally. I mean, it's still kind of a new model.
Mm-hmm.
So you have that in UMass Boston. There are a couple of other universities that are also looking at kind of these partnerships and how to structure them. It does depend. I mean, it depends on how much the university wants to let go of, you know, pricing and rental numbers. I mean, how much control they want to have.
Right. Okay. Well, let's go to our callers really quickly. David's calling from Charleston, South Carolina. David, you're on the air.
Hi, Meghna. Thanks for taking my call. I'll tell you, my daughter started her freshman year last year at Colorado State University, and she was a lot like you, Meghna. She had the cinder block room with the bunk beds and the two desks. This year, though, she's going to one of those communities. And I'll say, you know, she's very liberal. She's very involved with, you know, income inequality in this country, which we both agree is a huge problem. And I really don't believe that these types of communities, at least at CSU, perpetuate that. And I'll tell you the reason being is, number one, I don't think kids, for the most part, at a large university like that are singularly focused on income and that sort of that class ideal. I think that it's much more all of the kids are there learning who they are. And these communities offer something unique for these kids. They give them different types of communities to live in after that freshman year. Like, my daughter's going to a learning community with four, you know, individual rooms, four roommates with a common room, and she wanted that because of the social interaction. So her driving motive was not anything to do with income. This particular place isn't, you know, at the very high end of that, but it's certainly not at the low end. And then the cost of it was nominal compared to what we paid last year for her room and board. I would say it was merely a few hundred dollars difference in price.
I see.
So it really was not that huge of a difference, and it's going to be a great environment for her.
Okay. Well, David, thank you for your call. Let's go to Carla, who's calling from Decatur, Georgia. Carla, you're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm calling because I am all in support of students having nice places to live when they're going to college. I think wealthy students have always had that alternative, so I don't really think that's an issue. At Georgia Tech, I've lived in this area for more than three decades. That place was so glum until the Olympics hit, and then they built housing for the Olympics, which the students inherited.
Uh-huh.
And they had these, now they have beautiful housing there, and that has done a lot to transform that campus from a place where the students basically went through hell, you know, to one where they actually enjoy their college experience. So I think we underestimate the pressure that students are under nowadays and how difficult it can be when you're in this new environment to be living in crappy housing when you're dealing with so many other issues.
So, Carla, let me ask you a question. I totally hear you on that. But what about the example that we started off with from Deirdre Fernandez, where she was looking at a new college dorm at Northeastern University that was priced so high that only certain students could afford it? I mean, is that just so the students who can't afford it are still stuck in the sort of the quote unquote crappy student housing that you talked about?
I think that's a very good point. But places like Georgia Tech and UGA have multitudes of affordable housing where for only about another $500 a semester, $1,000 a semester, you can get better amenities.
I see.
I think if you have a place like Boston that's heavily built up and already very expensive, it's always going to be a problem. I don't know how you can reconcile that. I think if they concentrate on making the basic housing good, you know, no roaches, good laundromat, a nice lounge, you can go very far in helping all students have a better experience. But, you know, the richer students will always have advantages in getting nice housing.
Yeah. Well, Carla, thank you so much for your call. Deirdre, would you like to respond to that?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's a fair point. And it's actually, you know, colleges are trying to keep their students, right, attract new students and keep the students they have. So housing is one of the things that is really important to students. So you can understand where colleges want to create some sort of tiered system or, you know, for those students who can afford it, they can get different types of amenities included in the basic dorm room. The question is, you know, how much responsibility do colleges have to make it equal for everybody? And how much, I mean, they're already subsidizing housing for many students.
Yeah.
And how, I mean, should they be subsidizing it all the way to the kind of fanciest dorms or allow students who can't afford it to pay that?
Right. So we had that caller, David from South Carolina, saying that, you know, he had a daughter who was very socially aware, but wasn't maybe that the kids aren't kids. These are college students, that the students maybe aren't so singularly focused on the day-to-day issues of income inequality. But also both David and our other caller just said that the better housing wasn't actually on their campuses that much more expensive,
yeah,
which was interesting. So there are lots of different models here. We want to acknowledge that. But you talked to some kids, for example, at Tufts University. I keep calling them kids. Sorry, college students. You're adults. You talked to some students at Tufts University, for example, who objected to the fact of tiered housing, as they call it. What were their concerns?
Well, their concerns were Tufts was one of the schools that had a flat rate kind of for everybody. Everybody was paying the same for housing. And their concern was that it does create this system where, you know, you have students who are able and it can afford nicer places instead of being some sort of lottery system or some sort of, you know, everybody pays the same because you're getting this, you know, just by luck, you may get a nicer place. But for the college, that they want to add more housing and it costs money.
Yeah.
So this tiered system has come into place and they're trying to accommodate the financial aid. But for students, I mean, I think there are some students who do feel like there is a stratification happening.
Right. And that perhaps idealistic as it may seem,
yeah,
universities might be one of those places where market forces should be held at bay for at least a couple of years. I mean, again,
yeah,
I know like that sounds really Pollyannish when I say it out loud, but it's not exactly an unheard of idea.
Yeah. No, it does go to this kind of issue of, you know, should universities be some sort of great place where everything is equal and everything. I mean, it's, you know, reality isn't that way. And should universities be creating a society that is trying?
Well, let's just go to Jessica, who's calling from Spokane, Washington, who may have a thought on that. Jessica, you're on the air.
Hi there. My comment is that this divisiveness that we're talking about these luxury dorms creating exists already. It exists in the types of clothes that people wear, the technology that they carry, and things that just direct their everyday life. And that really, instead of focusing on luxury dorms, wouldn't it be interesting if the universities created sustainable housing, things that had solar panels and maybe reused gray water for flushing toilets, and so that everyone was saving money, the students, the universities, and that it was just a long-term sustainable option instead.
Yeah, well, Jessica, thank you so much for your call. Let's turn now to Joshua Brown. He joins us from Charlottesville, Virginia. He's a professor of education at the University of Virginia, and he's the lead author of a study that was published just last month in the Journal of Student Affairs Research and Practice. And that article was called The Hidden Structure, The Influence of Residence Hall Design on Academic Outcomes. Professor Brown, welcome to On Point.
Meghna, hello. Thank you for having me today.
Okay, so first of all, let me just get your big picture take here. Should universities be a place where market forces are kept at bay? Is there something to this idea that students are all mixed up together in dorms and not differentiated so much by income?
You know, I think the market factors and market forces that you mentioned have been traditionally at odds with the goals and aspirations of education in America. And you highlight those tensions very well. And I think that you see that come up with Deirdre's study and the tensions that individuals are objecting to.
And so meaning what?
Our society is stratified. And so as students enroll in colleges, as they come to the college, they should be they should have opportunities to interact with other individuals that are not necessarily like them, whether that be by race or socioeconomic status or a variety of other factors. When you group individuals according to those factors, you begin to govern and limit those, whether that be by policy that the organization creates or whether that be by structures, physical structures, which is what we're discussing here today.
Okay. So in this study that you published about the influence of residence hall design on academic outcomes, what did you find?
So we were approached by a school who had basically done what you all have been discussing here. Is there was a certain type of residence hall that had existed on campus, the traditional type that you described at the outset. And in an effort to begin to recruit and cater to some of the more modern demands, they built a series of luxury residence halls. And what they had asked us to do was to basically come in and evaluate and see to what extent we might be able to help them with their retention efforts from a residence hall standpoint. What we discovered is that there were differences and variations by those structures, and those differences played out by race. What we call homophily opportunity. Now, homophily is basically where individuals of like attributes sort of adhere together or are grouped together.
Yeah,
and then those the other factor was by GPA. So what we discovered is that at the predominantly white campus, there wasn't really any variation according or for the white individuals wherever they lived on campus, whether it was the isolating architecture, the luxury dorms, or if it was in the traditional, more socializing architecture. What we found was that it was very important, you were much more likely, for the black students were much more likely or had a higher associated GPA in the traditional setting than they did in the isolating setting. And we thought that would had very important implications for the way that not only universities pursued the design of their facilities or their residence halls, but also the ways in which the policies that they put forth for those individuals as well, whether that be selection or room changes or other policies that the organization might have over time.
Okay, interesting. So we're going to talk more about those implications when we come back from a quick break. We are talking this hour about private developers creating new college dormitories on various college campuses across the United States, and whether that might exacerbate some income inequality issues on American campuses, or if it's helping college campuses create much needed housing for students. We've got comments coming in on Facebook. Mary Nuswara says, I don't see this as being much different than the students who lived off campus. They could have stayed in a tin can dorm room, but instead just rented an apartment that was more to their liking. And J. Chris Henry says, they've done this at our little state school in East Tennessee State University in Johnson City. Smallish town of 45,000 with its own problem of not enough affordable housing for those already living here. We'll be back. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about private developers partnering with colleges and universities across the United States to build new student housing. Some of that housing is quite luxurious and quite expensive. Now, colleges say it's great because they don't have to pay to build it, and that money can then go to back into education, the core mission of a university. But other folks have some concerns, saying that if the housing is being built for only the students that can afford it, does that exacerbate some income inequality issues on American campuses in a way that mirrors the issues across the United States? I'm joined today by Deirdre Fernandez. She's a correspondent for the Boston Globe, and it's her story that has prompted this conversation today, and we have a link to it at onpointradio.org. Joshua Brown also joins us. He's a professor of education at the University of Virginia. And Deirdre and Joshua, there are so many comments coming in online. I'm just going to read a whole bunch of them because people are really interested in this. Okay, Barry Wythoff says, luxury dorms? The biggest problem with college right now is that it's too expensive, saddling kids and parents with long-term debt. Move in the wrong direction, Barry says. But Thinkin15 says, when I think of what my daughter's dorm housing cost for what looked like a prison cell and a shared bath with many others, even that was quite a racket for the colleges. Manny Goldstein, on the other hand, says, our son is in a newer dorm with central AC, carpeting, and sushi, much nicer than cinder blocks and linoleum and the rent-a-window fan that I had. But Todd in Snell Vega says, my daughter is $70,000 in debt, and the majority of that was housing. So, Deirdre, let me just get you to respond to that. Did the issue of the debt that students are already taking on, did that come up when talking to universities and private developers about what kind of housing they were going to build?
You know, it didn't really, but that is part of the expense that students are taking on, is the expense of where to live in their residence halls. That's a big issue of how much you can afford, how much debt you want to take, and what, if you have financial aid, how much is going to cover it? Do you want to take out more loans, or do your parents want to take out more loans to pay for...
to live in the better housing.
Yeah. But, I mean, I've gone to college campus tours with people, and housing is a big issue. I mean, parents will turn around and they say they want the most affordable options. But if you walk into
campus— But they don't want cinder blocks.
They don't want cinder blocks. Yeah. I mean, can be a turnoff, and it is a decision point for a lot of families.
Okay. So then on that point, Jim— from our website says he remembers when Northeastern was the first school to impose, in his words, luxury dorms. Then every college raced to build a dorm to compete for college applicants. So is there a race to the penthouse here? I mean, I don't know how to put it.
Right. I guess. Yeah. I mean, but colleges want students to come. And on the college tour, the college dorm is a central part of what you're looking at. And college is so expensive anyway for a lot of families. Mm-hmm. And when you're shelling out, you know, several tens of thousands of dollars a year, you want to feel like you're getting your money's worth.
Joshua Brown, you want to chime in on that?
Yeah. A lot of these organizations, these universities, are becoming more and more enrollment conscious. And they're having to... I think lure is not the right word, but entice students to enroll. And housing and amenities are the options that are being used, or one of the options that are being used. And as is highlighted here, is that students, in order to pay for this, are having, you know, by and large, having to take out loans. And those costs are being pushed down, you know, down the road. One of my concerns is that we're entering an era, as highlighted by some other researchers, where the traditional age college student, the 18 to 22-year-old, is about to take a precipitous drop due to birth rates that have been declining. So if colleges nationwide are continuing to build these dorms in order to enroll students or to attract students, at some point we're going to have more beds than we are going to have bodies. And the it will only continue to sort of intensify the competition among organizations and universities that already exists. And you're going to find that this the luxury aspect of it might have consequences that we don't even see as of yet.
Right.
And that's a great concern of mine.
Well, so Professor Brown and Deirdre Fernandez, stand by because, again, the callers, they're pounding down at the door here. So let's go to Brett, who's calling from Oakland, California. Brett, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. So I was at University of Michigan for grad school just last year. And something I noticed through just TAing or teacher assisting there was just the vast difference in different classes amongst the students in undergrad. And University of Michigan was one of the top schools, public schools with highest percentage from like the upper 1%. I think it was 10% of the students in 2016 came from the upper 1%. And I pulled up this report from New York Times. I wondered if people remember the social mobility issue. New York Times reported on it. U of M also ranked dead last amongst public universities for that metric. Mm-hmm. And it was students moving from the moving up to income quintiles after their degree.
Right.
And I just wondered, do we think that that would be maybe a way to look back on this? Unfortunately, it's moving forward. So looking back on it in 10 years and seeing, I would imagine that the social mobility will drop. Because what I haven't heard talked about was students, they'll go to fraternities or sororities, which are exclusive, but universities used to require students to stay in dorms the first year, which did force mixing, which I think is good for society. But do we think that maybe putting the profit first and looking at universities as profit-making machines, we're losing sight of what their purpose is for society, and we're not really forcing students to interact outside? And there's already an issue, as New York Times showed. Do we think it's just going to get worse?
So, Brett, thank you so much for that call. Professor Brown, let me turn back to you here, because I think Brett is very clearly getting at something which we did for a long time consider one of the missions of a university. And again, idealistic or not, that it was an opportunity for people from different backgrounds to form new relationships. And so if we're having more socioeconomic stratification with these new kinds of housing, you know, Brett's asking, is that going to inhibit the social mobility that could come or should come as part of the university experience?
Right. And I think his point is very well taken. And he highlights something that I was trying to give words to it. Maybe double stratification might be a term here. He highlighted that there was stratification across organizations, right? That individuals who were attending the University of Michigan were advantaged in many capacities. But if you take that idea, that's a single stratified, but if you take Deirdre's idea that now organizations or universities are doing differential pricing, rather than being stratified across schools, what you're seeing now is a further stratification within the school, right? So such that this group of students that might have more resources available to their disposal get to live in these facilities, and those individuals with fewer resources get to live in these facilities. And as a result, and what we don't measure in our study is because it's archival, we don't get to measure or talk to the students, right? This is a historical thing that we did. But what those groupings give you is access. They give you a network. Mm-hmm. And that network can be leveraged, as sociologists will tell you, leveraged later on in life, whether whether that's for marital reasons or for labor market reasons.
It can and is leveraged. I mean, right?
Correct.
That's the whole power of seeking to get into those networks.
Correct.
Yeah. Well, so Deirdre, I'm going to come back to you here in just a second, but let's go to Jesse, who's calling from Somerville, Massachusetts. Jesse, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm actually a student at Tufts University in undergrad right now. And I wanted to emphasize that this campus housing inequality doesn't exist in a vacuum. At Tufts, it's spilling over into the surrounding communities of Medford and Somerville, and having pretty bad effects on their housing markets, really bad gentrification effects. And so students on the Tufts campus have been working with community groups in Medford and Somerville on the housing crisis that's affecting all of us now. And for the past year, students in what we've called the Tufts Housing League have been organizing with our communities to brainstorm solutions to this crisis. But unfortunately, I know that Brett just made a comment that universities are kind of profit-making machines. When we share these concerns and ideas with Tufts, the administration doesn't listen to us.
Jesse, stand by here for just a second. Yeah, don't hang up. Just hang on, because I want to get Deirdre's take here on this, because she spoke with officials at Tufts about housing at that university. What's your response to what Jesse's saying?
Well, I know when I spoke with them, they were conscious about making sure that there was some sort of financial aid available for students as they were changing into a tier system. But it was an issue. I mean, they were the housing group, an student organization, was fighting it and was arguing for less stratification. So this is an issue that these universities are having to deal with. Like, you know, there is pushback from students. There's pushback from the community around them. So,
yeah. Well, Jesse, I mean, Tufts has also said that it wants to add, what, according to your reporting, Deirdre, six or 700 more beds and needs to update existing housing to keep it a place that students want to apply to. I mean, what's your thought on that?
Yeah, I mean, they've definitely already started those efforts of adding more beds. The problem, though, is that they're making rooms that were previously singles into doubles and rooms that were previously doubles into triples. So they're not actually building more housing. They're just cramming more students into the amount of housing that they have. So one of the demands of the Housing League was that they build a new dorm because, again, even with the financial aid that they are trying to push over into this new tiered system, the more expensive on-campus housing gets, the more students move off. And that affects the residents of Medford and Somerville who are being pushed further and further away from the Tufts campus because that housing is being taken up by students who can no longer afford to live on campus.
The spillover effects you were talking about there. Well, Jesse, thank you so much for your call. Let's go to David, who's calling from Atlanta, Georgia. David, you're on the air.
Thanks for my call. Yeah, I was just talking as an older student. I went to college in the 80s and then also in the service. And unless the U.S. government is going to mandate that college is for everyone, like high school, then you're always going to have executive privilege. You're always going to have someone that can afford more than someone else. You can't make it like in the service where you strip them down to everyone is the same. So I don't know, other than making housing, trying to level it out as, all right, we got so many for the rich and so many for the underprivileged people housing, then the problem is always going to exist.
Mm-hmm.
I don't see how you're going to fix it.
Yeah, well, David, thank you for your call. So Professor Brown, I mean, David's saying the world's always had haves and have-nots. But thinking of that point, Professor, I'm wondering, what would you recommend that colleges and universities do? Because through the course of this hour, we've also heard sort of the various pressures that campuses are saying that they're facing. They need to stay competitive, need to keep being attractive places for students to apply to. They need to upgrade their existing dorms. I mean, so what would you recommend they do in order to achieve all that, but while not stratifying campus life?
I think that it's going to require a very hard, thoughtful, and maybe even painful look at their policies, how students are allocated within the residence halls, whether that's by choice, again, whether that's they have the opportunity to live on or off that first year. Those social structures are going to be extremely important for matters of retention, right? So there's decades worth of higher education research that shows that the more a student is engaged, he or she is more likely to continue and persist at the university. The paradox comes is that when you build structures that are inherently isolating, you begin to put what we know as decades of research into sort of a tension there. You've got amenities and preferences on one hand where you have isolation, and on the other hand, those might undermine the success, particularly in the first year for students. It might undermine the success, whether that's social success or academic success. I would just encourage administrators that as they begin to look to build or continue to build these structures, that they evaluate that. And for those structures that are already erected, what thoughtful or evaluative efforts can they undertake to begin to look at what's already been built, and how can the academic and social aspects be more given further attention? Mm-hmm. I would give those items input for them.
So, Deirdre, we've just got about a minute here left to go. I mean, as you did this reporting, did you come away with the feeling that that it's inevitable that universities are going to continue to perhaps work with more private developers to build this new housing?
Yeah. I mean, even some of the local universities here are exploring partnerships that haven't been public or just are in talks about how to build new dorms, refurbish their dorms, renovate. I think that the costs are so high that it's almost inevitable, because it costs, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars to build these dorms, that it's inevitable for them to start looking and exploring these partnerships and seeing it as a way to save money.
Hmm. Well, I'm going to give the last thought here to a commenter on our website. I guess Hefe68 says, the reality here is while colleges are structured as not-for-profit, the entire model is now based on a for-profit corporate model. And Hefe says, denying that is foolish. This is the problem. The debt students are leaving with is out of control. And when it crashes, it's going to bring down the economy with it. It's unsustainable. Well, Joshua Brown, professor of education at the University of Virginia and lead author of a study published last month in the Journal of Student Affairs, Research and Practice, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Deirdre Fernandez, correspondent for the Boston Globe, covering New England's education economy. We have a link to her story on student housing and private developers at onpointradio.org. Deirdre, it's been great to have you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Also, I should let everyone know that while I was waxing nostalgic about the cinder blocks and linoleum and cheap bunk beds of my freshman year college dorm room, I'll be perfectly honest, as soon as I was able to afford my own place and live on my own, I loved that too. So it's complicated. Thanks for listening. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.